Well, good morning, everybody. This is Bob Elson. We're set as usual for our Sunday morning show. And as most of you know, the Bears are not playing today, but they're the Monday night attraction. And they'll be out where the weather is nice in San Diego. And let's hope that they continue. They've been playing better in the last couple of games. They still don't seem to impress anybody too much, but another win would probably help. There are four games on television today, four football games, and the big one, the one I'm waiting for, is the Dallas-New England game. That'll be on at 3 o'clock, and that should be some kind of a football game. New England had Grogan, a quarterback who's a running quarterback. It'll be interesting to see how Dallas and Landry, how they defense New England. But they have, in my book, the best quarterback in the business, Roger Staubach. He was an All-American at Navy. He's an All-American guy, a very high-class guy. And he gives you really almost the insight of a coach out there. So that'll be a great game to look forward to, and that's today at 3 o'clock. Speaking of football, we're delighted today to have a guy who, when you talk about football, George Connor is, he's not only was a great football player, but he's one of the greatest guys I've ever met. He's associated with a fine company, Horner Waldorf, and has the rare distinction of being in the Pro Football Hall of Fame and the College Hall of Fame. And I want to tell you today, talking football, you'll hear a guy that knows about this game inside and out. So we're delighted to have George here today. He'll be with us in just about 1 minute. It's a real pleasure to have George Connor on our program. This is probably the 25th time that I've talked to George over the last 20 or 25 years, but it's a real pleasure to talk with him anytime about football, because not only was he a great player, but he follows the game today, the college game and the pro game, and incidentally does an excellent job as a commentator on the Notre Dame games. And Notre Dame has had George, what you'd call a pretty good season, the way they look at football now at South Bend, right?
Well, they were national champs last year. They came off the floor losing a game to Mississippi and then went on and won the rest and then had that tremendous game against Texas down there, and they beat Texas in the Cotton Bowl 38-10. They stopped one of the truly great runners who has really blossomed into a great pro, Earl Campbell with Houston. They held him in tow. And then they had a lot of plaudits, which goes with any championship team. I think the players probably were a little bit too confident, overconfident. Maybe the coaching staff, you've seen that with championship teams. They started out this year. They lost to a Missouri team 3-0. They were beaten by a good Michigan team, and then they decided to roll up their sleeves and go to work, and I think they had a good year. And, of course, the game last Saturday against USC, when they came back from 24-6 at the start of the fourth period, thought they had it won and then lost it. I thought that was a classic game.
George, working on the Notre Dame games, have you had a chance to spend any time with Devine?
Well, I know Coach Devine very well. He is a type of man. He's a quiet man. He keeps within himself. He's not an era Parsegian. He's not a lay. He's Dan Devine. He's a very sincere man. I think one of his big attributes recruiting, he's an excellent recruiter. Notre Dame has terrific material. He goes into a home, and he's a short man, as against the size of me or Moose Kraus, and I think that helps him in recruiting. The mothers and the fathers aren't afraid of him. He's a gentleman. And he does an excellent job recruiting. In his coaching, he delegates a lot. He is the head man. He delegates, which coach, Frank Leahy, did. I think he's done an excellent job at the University of Notre Dame.
There's so much history associated with the name of Newt Rockne. Do you have any regrets that you weren't part of his time?
Well, hearing stories from you, Bob, and, of course, from Judge Norman Berry, and from all kinds of people. I never met the man. I just last a week ago Sunday night, I saw Newt Rockne All-American. I cried again. I'm not ashamed to say that I did that. They used to show it to the freshmen down at Notre Dame. Certainly, you know, one of the great legends, but I never had the opportunity to meet him. But I did play under one of his pupils, Frank Leahy, and, of course, Rockne will always be remembered.
Yes, he was really a marvelous man. He was really a super, super salesman. I was with him visiting with Arch Ward the day that he was killed. And Arch Ward and I were in the Tribune Tower. We went downstairs and put Newt Rockne in a cab. And later on, I went over to record a recording studio. I came out about 5 o'clock, and I saw the headline. I couldn't believe it. Newt Rockne dies in crash. He was a marvelous, marvelous man, a super salesman. And I'm sure he'll always be remembered by football fans. But at Notre Dame, Newt Rockne will be remembered by generations still to come.
Well, he started something down at Notre Dame, Bob, and Notre Dame does things differently. Where Bear Bryant down at Alabama, they have a dormitory where all the athletes live. They do it at a lot of other Southern universities. And I guess their feeling is to put all the athletes together. You develop a esprit de corps. They're available for team meetings and stuff like that. But Rockne at Notre Dame, because he was a outstanding chemist. In fact, he was a professor after he graduated down there. He always roomed an athlete with a non-athlete. And they asked him why he did that, and he said, I did it so the athlete could help the non-athlete with his studies.
That's a good story. Well, what about all those Ziggy Zarabsky stories? You were telling us before we were in the boss's office, or you were telling us about a story about New York at the Waldorf?
Well, the Collegiate Hall of Fame dinner is next Tuesday night in New York, and they induct 9 players and 1 coach. And a number of years ago, Ziggy and my brother Jack and I were in New York for the big dinner. It's a black tie dinner, $150 a plate. They have about 1,500 people there. And we were riding down on an elevator in the Waldorf, and another couple, an elderly couple, were on the elevator. And Ziggy Zarabsky looked at this gentleman. He said, pardon me, sir, but aren't you General Omar Bradley? He said, yes, I am. And he said, I'm Ziggy Zarabsky. This is Jack and George Connor from Notre Dame. And he introduced Mrs. Bradley. And the general said, gee, fellas, he said, I want to thank you very sincerely for the many hours of enjoyment that you've given me and the fans around the country for your great football at Notre Dame. And Ziggy looked the general right in the eye, and he said, gee, General, we also enjoyed your wars.
That sounds like him. What kind, you know, I'm really surprised some of the stories you tell about Frank Leahy. He seemed like such a quiet, placid gentleman who wouldn't say boo. He was a tough guy as a coach.
Well, he was a great taskmaster. We might run the same play 30 or 40, maybe 50 times before we got it right. One thing he did, he coached his coaches before they went out to coach us. He was the first coach to have a tower, and he'd go up in the tower and he'd oversee practice, and we swore that he had eyes in the back of his head. And we had a lot of fun, though, playing. We made our own fun. But by the time the game started, we were either in the hospital or we were in the greatest shape of any team in the world. And the games on Saturday were just very, very easy.
George, did Rockne introduce the box and the shift?
Yes, Rockne, if anybody in the savings and loan here that saw the movie last Sunday night, he was watching a floor show, some dancing girls, and that's where he got the idea for the Notre Dame shift. And then he perfected that, and then, of course, the T formation came along, and they thought it was heresy at Notre Dame in 1941 when Frank Leahy was going to go to the T formation. In fact, he had Sid Luckman down there to help him install the tee, and they had a little trouble. I think they lost their first game, but they went on, and, of course, you can do so many, many, many more things from the tee formation than you can do from the Notre Dame box.
Yeah. Do you recall that the Cardinals, when they had their great backfield, Chrisman at quarterback, Angsman and Goldberg and Harder, they used the box in the shift?
Yes, they did. I hate to think about the Cardinals, Bob. I'm sorry you brought that up.
Well, the Cardinals and the Bears always got along pretty well.
Well, we had a friendly rivalry. In fact, I lived out in the South Side at that time, and I probably spent more time with the Cardinals than I did with my Bear teammates.
Well, that's the only time I saw the shift, and all of a sudden it disappeared. Why?
Well, you just couldn't do the things from it, and the new innovation, Bob, if you watch the USC-Notre Dame game, the I formation is really the thing. Put that tailback back about 7.5 yards, the fullback about 3.5 yards. You can go either direction. They can't key, you know, you're not set up. And you can pass from it, you can run from it. The runner can run towards the hole. He can watch the blocking. They can go either way. He follows the blocks. And certainly the I formation is the formation today.
What happened to Pop Warner's double wing and single wing?
Well, that was, I played in the single wing and double wing when I was at Holy Cross. But once again, it was a different type of football. It was a knockdown, drag out, close formation, a lot of double teaming. But they got away from that. And that was the beauty of the tee, because you could hit with a stand-up block, open up a hole, and boom, the back's through there. And you could do more passing from the tee than the single wing.
Working the Notre Dame-Southern California game, it had to be one of the great games of the year. You had an interesting observation on that great runner, how they use him, and why don't the Bears use Peyton the same way?
Well, you're talking about Charles White, the tailback for USC. He gained over 200 and some yards. They put him back in the tail of the eye, and then they would run him in motion, usually to his right, and which would mean he'd still be 7.5 yards behind the line of scrimmage, and maybe a defensive back or a lineman could react. Then they would throw him the football, which it had to be completed because the back couldn't come across the line, and then he had the open field to run, and I don't know why they don't do that with Walter Payton. I think I'll write the Bears and give them my suggestion.
Well, I'm sure that they could use it. I don't know. They don't seem to... I don't know what they do. You must watch the Bears a lot. What is it with the Bears?
Well, they're an ultra-conservative team, and I don't know why they're that way. I guess your team has to reflect in your coaching philosophies. I feel that the Bears coming on, winning their last couple of games, is not necessarily the improvement by the Bears players themselves, is that the coaching staff is finally gelled. And I think that's one thing that happened to the Bears. Last year, they got that miracle pass against Kansas City that Latta caught in the end zone, and then they went on to win, and they got in the playoffs, and I think they fooled themselves into thinking they were a better team than they were. And then they started out this year, and they won three games, but the Pardee incident with Jim Finks had a lot to do with it. Pardee led Finks along, and all of a sudden he found out that he was talking with the Redskins, and he let him go, and this forced Finks to go out and look for a coach and didn't give him a lot of time. He finally got Neil Armstrong. He had to put a staff together late, and I do think the improvement in the Bears in the last couple of weeks is the gelling of the coaching staff together into a unit, and they're being coached in a better fashion.
Our guest today, we're delighted to have him, former Notre Dame star and former pro star George Conner. And we're delighted to have him as a guest today. He'll be back with us in just about 1 minute. We're delighted to have George Conner as our guest today. He works for a company by the name of Horner Waldorf. Your company is in what business? Boxes, paper?
Well, we manufacture corrugated shipping containers, folding cartons, mold-to-wall bags, grocery sacks, and we're part of Champion International, which is the second largest forest product company in the world now.
It's an interesting newsletter you send out.
Well, about 20 years ago, Bob, when I was doing the Bear games, I got an idea for a newsletter, and I took it to our boss, Dick Horner. And we send out about 10,000 football letters weekly. We have 9 weeks of golf and 5 weeks of tennis, and it's a good way to get the name of our company across our potential buyer's desk.
Well, it's very interesting, too. I really look forward to it.
Well, what I try to do in the letter is to put items in there that you don't read in your daily paper, a little behind-the-scenes stuff, theories. One thing that I've talked about this year and years before, with all the injuries in football, I'm a sincere guy when I say that I think they ought to remove the face mask from the helmet. Years ago, we didn't have the face mask. Helmets have improved. But what's happened, it started down in the Pop Warner League and worked up through the high schools. And you had some coaches that taught these kids to use the helmet as a weapon instead of a protective thing to spear. And you see a lot of it on television. And I think they ought to remove it. And then that will keep the player from using the helmet as a weapon.
I know you watch all the games on Sunday and probably on Saturday, too. One of the things I've noticed with a team using a lot of passing formation, Dallas has an interesting shift that they go into.
Well, to play for Dallas, when they are interested in a player in college, they actually send them an IQ test, and they have to fill it out, and they do extensive interviewing. They have a great computer program. And to play regularly for the Dallas Cowboys might take a player two to three years because of their multiple shifts. If you watch them, you just wonder when the play is ever going to get going. But you have to be intelligent to play the game of football with any team. But more and more teams are going to the multiple shift that Tom Landry has.
Yes, the one that they use especially on third down, you call that.
Well, that's they call it the shotgun. That's nothing new. That's more like what you were talking about, the old single wing. That's just the tailback of the single wing. They drop Staubach there, and the interesting thing about it, if the fans listening haven't watched, that the center he keeps his head up so he can see who he's going to block, and he just flips the ball back. Occasionally he misses, and Staubach is either fumbles it or has got to dive for it, but he's only back 3 yards, so it's just a flip backwards.
Someone made the comment on the program, I don't know what, maybe it was Sid Luckman, an old friend of yours, a few weeks ago, that it's getting so with the defenses today in football that a quarterback has got to move. He can't stay in the pocket. He's got to go to one side or the other.
Well, you talk about the injuries to all the quarterbacks. I don't feel sorry for them, Bob, because they make a heck of a lot more money than the rest of the team. But a good quarterback, Sammy Baugh, I think, was the best I ever played against. He was about 6'5", and he had long arms, and he could ward the players off when he was going back to pass. You never got to him. But I think the rollout quarterback, you've got to do it. Quarterbacks have got to protect themselves. And most good quarterbacks, when they get hit from the blind side, but they seemingly have an instinct of feeling, and you could do this yourself. Have you ever felt where somebody's coming up behind you? Uh-huh. And most good quarterbacks have that, and I think in Avellini's case that he holds on to the ball too long. He maybe doesn't have that sense of somebody getting near him, but I think the good quarterback will either fall down or run with it. They got to make that decision when to run and when to take a sack.
You were famous for the defensive side of football, which is certainly as important as the offensive side. What is the key, George, to building a good defense? What's the key to the whole situation?
Well, number one, I think you have to have players with a lot of desire. Defense is a lot different than offense. I played both, but very sincerely, I preferred the defense because you're attacking the other team. I think with the coming of the huge linemen, we had a lot of big linemen, but certainly not the size of the general size of all the players. They've got to use their hands well. Linebacking has changed. I was the first big mobile linebacker at 6'3", 240. Now you don't have to be that big to be a linebacker because they're going to the three-man line. Because the players are getting bigger and they can cover more ground. Then they've gone to four linebackers, so they have to be more mobile. They have to drop back in the pass defense. Certainly, to play cornerback or free safety, that position has changed because you have to have so much more speed than you did. And you don't have to tackle as much because of your front linemen and linebackers are doing more of that. So certainly it has changed, but I really think the key to a great defense are the linebackers.
George, a couple of items that have dropped out of football, maybe they were there when you were active, especially at Notre Dame. The quick kick seems to have disappeared. It may have something to do with the alignment in the backfield. And also, the philosophy of, rather than punting high, of kicking, getting a guy to practice, and kicking that ball out of bounds. I've seen guys catch a football and go the whole length of the field.
Well, certainly everything changed. The quick kick is out, Bob, because you don't want to give the ball up anymore. It used to be, they were in the tight formations. You had low-scoring games, so if you could put the team down in the hole and wait for the break, that was Southeastern Conference football. They always punted on third down. General Bob Nalen, he'd punt on first time down sometime, but with the flexibility of the offense, you can score, you want to control the ball, so that reason's out. Now, that's been a pet peeve of mine, and they talk about kicking, how high it's going, hang time, but the coffin corner kick, I think that's a very artful thing, and I think the kicker, a lot of these kickers, like baseball, they have clauses in their contract. And I say if the kicker is punting from inside the 50 and he kicks it into the end zone, they ought to take 20 yards off his average. And if he kicks it inside the 15 on in and puts it out in the coffin corner, then he ought to get a bonus for that. And there should be an incentive in there, and there isn't, but there's more and more teams that are recognizing this and going for the coffin corner kick.
You were saying you didn't have a chance to see the Texas game last night.
No, I didn't, Bob.
Well, they got the greatest kicker in the country. This guy punts the ball 70 yards. He kicked a 59-yard field goal.
Well, that's
what the Bears need, a guy like that.
Well, Bob Parsons is a journeyman punter. I think Thomas has certainly improved as a field goal kicker. The last two or three weeks, he hasn't had much of an opportunity to kick.
As a pro and a great college player, too, you know the advantage of having a guy kick and kick off and kick it over the end zone, don't you?
Well,
it's pretty nice to have him walk out to the 20-yard line instead of being at midfield.
Well, Bob, when I was at Notre Dame, I was their kickoff man. I came up to the Bears, and I kicked off. And, of course, I was playing offense and defense, and I'd get the ball always down to the goal line, sometimes into the end zone. And now all these fellas do, they're specialists, and they kick off, and it just, I don't understand it if they can't kick the ball down into the end zone. That's what they're paid for. That's all they do. And for the youths listening, Bob, if a father has got a son that he wants him to play college and professional football, and he really doesn't have a great running ability or pass catching, teach the kid how to center. I tell you what, if a kid can learn how to center for deep punt formation, he can make any pro team in the country. And that's another lost art. Really.
That's interesting. Our guest today, and we're delighted to have him, is an old friend and a great, really great football player at Notre Dame and as a pro, George Connor. We'll be back with our guest in just about 1 minute. We're delighted to be talking football with George Connor. George, quickly, what would you say was the highlight of your college career? What was the highlight of your pro career?
Well, in college, we ended our season in 47. Notre Dame hadn't been unbeaten and untied in 17 seasons. We went out to play the University of Southern California, and early in the second period, and the score was, I think we were leading 13-7 or something, and Bob Livingston broke off right tackle, and I was a left tackle, and I came around along with Jim Martin and led the interference and actually kept ahead of Bob Livingston, who had good speed, and knocked down a safety man, and he went in to score, and we beat him 38-7. In professional football, I had, you know, so many thrills. I think it was just a thrill to play in my hometown, Chicago, Illinois, which I think is the greatest city in the world, and to play with the Bears and with such great people. But I had one thing that did happen. We were playing the Lions. Bobby Lane was the quarterback, and we were trailing, and we tried a four-man line, a five-man line, and finally I said, let's go with the six-man line. We did. Sprinkle, Ed Sprinkle, and Doug Atkins knocked Bobby Lane down. The ball was there. I picked it up, raced for the goal line. I was zigging and zagging, and I heard footsteps behind me, and finally Fred Williams said, Connor, if you don't hurry up, we're going to pass you and go into the end zone, and I scored a touchdown, my only professional touchdown, and we beat the Lions 21-20.
Well, those really are a couple of thrills. We're going to be talking football again next week with a mutual friend of yours and mine, Hugh Galanou.
Well, Hugh is a great athlete, and as you know, he went to high school at Morgan Park, never played football in high school, was on the track team at Stanford, and Clark Shaughnessy picked him up. Bob, before we close, and I know your time is running short, I have a little Irish mother out in the south side of Chicago that's going to be interesting. Listening, and she's a great woman. She gave me a lot of courage that mothers do. As you know, I was a premature baby. She really took care of me, and I just want to say hi to Mother out in the south side of Chicago.
That's nice, George. Thank you, George, so much for being with us. And continued success to you in your chosen profession with Horner Waldorf. And I don't know anybody around, and I know a lot of radio announcers and a lot of writers who got more friends than you have.
Thank you, Bob.
Our guest today, George Connor, great football player at Notre Dame and a great pro, made the college and also the pro All-American. We were mentioning that we have as a guest next week another All-American, Hugh Galanou, who's in the clothing business with Hart, Schaffner & Marks, another wonderful guy. Well, don't look for the Bears today, but look for them tomorrow night. And say a few prayers for them. That's a Monday night game. They'll be playing San Diego. Whatever you do, have a happy day. And now this is Bob Elson saying goodbye until next Sunday at our usual time.